Welcome to The Paleo View. I'm bestselling author and co-creator of realeverything.com, Stacy Toth. I focus on being healthy inside and out through real life, food, and talk.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times bestselling author and creator of thepaleomom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
Welcome back, listeners. We have survived technology challenges and are excited to be here with you today.
So I have to tell you that, like, my number one biggest pet peeve in life is having to do something twice. Like, if it's like I messed up, you know, like it's fine, like I learn a lesson. But if it's like the universe was just being a jerk, for example, not recording your audio, it's like one of the things that it just irks me to my core. So the way that I like tried to process that emotion before doing this, I hope will be like really outstanding because it'll be like the second run of this podcast, is I actually did more research. So I have more things to talk about, Stacy.
Well, that's exciting for me, but for everybody else, it's just going to be research.
Right. For that, well, see, what they're getting, though, if they had actually gotten this podcast last week, they would have not learned as much. And so now that they're listening to it this week, because last week it didn't exist and we had to share the second podcast that we had recorded early so that I didn't need to podcast immediately upon coming home from a camping trip. Instead, well, they get me immediately coming home from a camping trip, but they also get like more information, and I think it's going to be great.
Well, awesome. If you are not familiar, if you didn't hear last week's episode, Sarah and I recorded this topic and I had a headset that was dying and now it's working. We got a new headset. We fortunately also recorded last week's show, which we had done ahead of time because we were traveling. Now we're good. So fortunately, while the universe was cruel, it also did it at an okay time. And now we're back with you. And I think relative to the topic, it actually makes sense because both Sarah and I had to persevere and push through finding the positive and focusing on it, which is what we're going to talk about today. But can I just tell you that this is the last week of the fiscal year? So,
I'm sorry. It's the worst week of the year for you every year.
Well, it's the best and worst. It's the busiest week of the year for me. Yeah. I'll say that. And it's
busiest.
Yes. You know, for a tax professional, it's overwhelming what you have to do, but also like, hey, look at all this work I'm doing. That's great. That's where I am. So just be warned, listeners. It's, you know, later than it usually is when we start. And I literally walked in the door, didn't even get to take off my bra, and now I'm recording.
So, excellent situation for this week's topic.
Exactly.
Do you want to just get into it?
All right. So, I came back from my trip to Nantucket, which was an all-women's leadership conference.
Do you meet a man? 10th. From Nantucket? Sorry.
That pun was just...
So, funny story, you never mentioned you were in Nantucket when we recorded last week. I didn't have the opportunity to reference the limerick.
There you go. See, you're already benefiting, listeners. Aren't you so
much better?
Grateful that you got Sarah's bad limerick. Yes, I was in Nantucket and I didn't see the man I was at. A women's conference. It wasn't like a women's conference. It was a conference and it was populated by 99.9% women.
All right.
And I had a couple of like experiences where I realized that I had been expecting negativity and pushback and cattiness, and therefore that was what I was perceiving and thusly getting, right? Like if that's what I was putting out into the ethos as something to expect, then no matter what situation was happening, that's what I was perceiving and coming and reflecting back on me. And it occurred to me because I realized while I was there that some of the things that I was expecting were ridiculous, that people were actually nice or, you know, not as judgmental as I had anticipated them to be or whatever the case was. And it made me realize how very much this idea of expectation and positive thought impacts our daily life. And, you know, while you're going to talk about evidently even more science on some of that from a bigger picture perspective for how it might play into your life, whether it's, you know, at the gym or at the PTA group or whatever. For me, you know, I'm a woman with a full-time job and I am an executive at an IT consulting firm. And for the most part, I work with men. So while I've been used to working in that environment, it has been a learning curve for me as I started a business that is predominantly women. And so at this leadership conference, I'm representing my team of over 250 women, and I'm learning educational information, and I'm networking with other women who run their businesses to think, how can we share our mission? How can we, you know, benefit these women financially? How can we do all of these things the best way? And I will say there is some of a small minority, you know, of people who are what I will lovingly refer to as information hoarders, right? Like they're like, well, if I have this information and it's good for me and it's good for my team, I don't want to share it with anybody else because this piece of pie is all we have. And therefore I want as much of that piece of pie as possible. And if I hoard my information, maybe I'll get more of the piece of pie than other people. And I think what occurred to me is that we don't just have a piece of pie. We have the whole pie. And when we work together and we share ideas and we network and we brainstorm collaboratively in whatever your situation or life is, you have the opportunity to figure out how to get the whole pie. And, you know, I think if we don't think positively and if we don't expect the best outcome, then we're never going to get it, right? But if this idea of always assuming the best of someone is something that I personally am working on because it's not my instinct. I'm a very worst case scenario, logical type person. And so when it comes to relationships and people, and especially working with women, like I have to actively tell myself, it is not the case that this person is actively out to get you in most scenarios, right? Like maybe there's a small fraction of people.
Every once in a while.
And I get it. I'm a strong personality. But for the most part, we all want to learn from each other. And so this idea kind of brought together two things for me. One, that, you know, I personally need to have better expectations. I need to walk into a room not thinking, what are all the negative things being said about me? Or what is the disaster that's going to happen? Or whatever. I need to walk into a room and think, how great is it that I can make connections and share information and meet new people that can broaden my world when I walk into this room? And when I walked into a room with that mindset, I did meet new people and I established relationships and I created friendships that, you know, help not just myself and that person, but the hundreds of women that we work with that we can then share that information and relationship with. And so that perspective really brought me to this idea of focusing on the positive, not just, you know, working together and lifting each other up, which I think is super important. But I think that's part of a broader conversation that you and I wanted to have once we started talking about it, which is this idea that when you think positively and when you focus on the things that are going well instead of dragging yourself down on the things that aren't, you actually have improved health and therefore things will get better, right? Like if you can literally manifest your own mindset if you want to. And the thing is, it's hard. Like I said, I am not instinctually that kind of positive person. So I wanted just to like brainstorm that with you and with our listeners, because I think it's something that we need to talk about more often. And we need to be open about the fact that, you know, some of us have these negative perceptions or feelings, and maybe they're intentional or not. What can we do about it? And, you know, maybe if we understand the drivers of how it's affecting our health or, you know, coping mechanisms for it and things like that, it could help us be better personally, well, healthy, all that kind of stuff.
And I love what you said about fighting for each having your own piece of the pie versus like collectively working for the whole pie. I think it's one of the things that is happening more and more in society as we get more isolated. You know, one of the things that social media has done is it's actually made us more isolated. It gives us sort of the illusion of connection, but there's studies now showing that social media use can magnify depression. It can magnify feelings like jealousy. It can basically make us feel like we're inadequate. And I think part of that is the tendency to sort of post the best and the worst on social media, and like none of the mundane in between, where most of our lives is that sort of routine stuff in between that we tend not to think is post-worthy. But I think that, you know, it's the fact that we're working more than we ever have before. The fact that we, you know, it's really hard now to not be in a dual income household. Like the exception is now the single income household. And so I think that what's happening is we've become isolated in a way, and sort of combined that with the way jobs are structured now. It's all about standing out, the search for, you know, power and promotion, and that drive for the next step up, because that's going to come with the raise, and the raise is going to allow me to retire early. I think so many of us are kind of stuck in this hamster wheel of work hard, be better than the person next to me so I can get the whatever it is, and at the same time, we've lost a lot of our sort of our social structure. You know, in pre-internet, you know, it was more common to like really know your neighbors, to, you know, have a conversation with somebody that you bump into. And I think those things still happen, but it's not quite the same as it was, let's say, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And I think that one of the sort of side effects of this, the way that the internet has really shifted society, is that as much as we get put in situations where we need to be collaborative in certain jobs, when we're in that mindset of entrepreneur, of running my own business, of, you know, seeking the promotion, we tend to forget the importance of collaboration and teamwork, and the fact that we can all rise each other up, and that if we work together towards something, we can lift everyone up. And it doesn't need to be a fighting for the last, you know, scrap. We can all rise up together with a less competitive and a more collaborative mindset.
Yeah, totally love that visual. And also the idea that you said we need to step up in our lives, whether, you know, we are trying to get a promotion or get ahead or, you know, whatever it is. I think we sometimes confuse step up with step on in that comparison mindset, right? Like we don't need to take someone down to lift each other up. I think like there's a couple of, you know, things that I can refer to here. You know, like there's a popular quote, you know, strong women lift each other up. And this idea of, you know, fighting for this piece of pie versus the whole pie. Like, if you think about a group of ants, right, like they could all fight each other for the small crumb, or they can work together as, you know, hundreds of them and take the whole pie back to the anthill for everybody to feed, right? And I think that is the abundance mindset that is so lost so often, because we are in a chaos and we are in a hustle. And, you know, I see it even in my children's school, because everybody wants their kid to be top of class. Well, you can't all be top of class. That's what an average is for. Like, there has to be an average. And it's okay. Like, my kids are average. Like, they're, and that's okay. I mean, they're great and I love them, right? But like, it's interesting to me when I talk to teachers who, you know, when I say to them, Wesley is an artistic guy. Like, he's imagination 100%. He is never going to be like your top math student or your top English writing student, but he is going to love art and he is going to love music. And I want to foster that in him, yeah, because that's his personality. And it's crazy to me that like it's like the teacher has never heard this before, because I think, like you said, years and years ago that was the way, but it's not anymore. And I don't want you listener to think, well, you know, I want my kid to do well in school, Stacey, you're crazy. No, of course not. But I'm saying, like, that's not his strength, right? I want my kids to be the best versions of themselves at all times. And that's an abundance mindset. That's their best version of them. I want to be the best version of me. And that means that I need to work well with others, and I need to play nice in the sandbox, and I need to do all the same things that I'm teaching my kids to do, because it will help big picture that if we all work together to carry that pie back to the anthill, we can all have it. Right. So no, I loved your analogy, and I think maybe we could talk about some of the reasons why this is not just good for us and our personal relations, but also our health. Because I know for me, this is one of the things that you and I talked about years and years ago when I was starting AIP and I didn't see results for years. And you hesitantly, like trepidatiously, were like, well, I've noticed you're a little stressed out and high strung. Let me share this chapter of my book with you.
I'm sure that's not how that went down, but that's probably a good summary. It's the like cautiously raising my hand. I'm like, excuse me. Might have just a light just for you to consider. Yeah. You know, as you know, when you told me that you wanted to tackle the topic of abundance mindset for the podcast, one of the ways that you phrased, you know, research, how we can tackle this from a scientific perspective and sort of dig into some of the research was, I think you phrased the question something like, is there any science behind the secret mindset? Or the behind the secret, which is basically, you know, short.
I just want to be clear that I was definitely using quotation marks when I said the secret.
No, I mean, I don't want to imply that that is what you're talking about, but basically the idea of if I believe it, it will happen, right? And I want to emphasize that what we're talking about is different than, I believe that I will win the lottery, so it will happen, right? It's much more complex than that. Where my entry point was taking that and thinking, okay, so where in our health journeys does believing an outcome will happen when does that actually affect the outcome? And as I was trying to figure out where to start my research, the first thing I actually was thinking about was the placebo effect, which is really legitimately, I believe that this little sugar pill that someone told me is a pill to lower my cholesterol, I believe this is going to lower my cholesterol. And sure enough, that ends up becoming like there is a measurable reduction in cholesterol. And so there is this well-established effect in the medical literature that is, it's called the placebo effect. And it is an actual measurable effect from giving a patient it's typically like something harmless, like it's usually a sugar pill, and telling that patient that this is going to have the effect. So I'm going to give you this. I'm telling you this is a drug, and this drug is going to lower your cholesterol, but I don't actually give it to you. I deceive you, but you believe that drug is going to lower your cholesterol, and as a result, your cholesterol lowers. And so in medical research, there is that. This is why there's always a control group, and it's because of the placebo effect. So it's typically a small effect, something like 5%. But it depends on exactly what you're measuring. And in some areas, it can be a bigger effect than that. And researchers always have to tease out like the effect of the drug versus placebo. It's not the effect of the drug versus no drug. It's the effect of the drug versus placebo that really is important. And so as I was kind of digging into that research, I also was thinking about mindset in cancer patients, because there is a fairly extensive body of literature looking at things like hope, optimism, belief in cancer patients and looking at their survival. And that really brought me to this really fascinating field of psychology that basically looks at positive affect and optimism and the roles that these have in health. And it, to me, it's fascinating because this gets much, much deeper than placebo effect, because it's no longer belief, but it's actually like a general approach to life. And I felt like this field of research more encompassed your experience in Nantucket. I'm saying the limerick to myself in my head and it's distracting me right now.
So what I do want to say is at least you're not singing this week, because we had active sing song in the last recording of this.
Oh, the night is young. The night is young.
Oh no. You poor listeners.
But I do, I think that, you know, to distill your experience, it was the discovery that a negative affect was holding you back and the intentional adoption of a positive affect and the discovery of the benefits of that. And so I thought that would be really interesting to dig into. We actually have a question from a listener that fits into this perfectly. So I do want to read that question and then we can dive into this research.
What's exciting is that we've got the name of this question asker this week, right?
Yes. Yes. We made special notes to make sure that we grabbed the name out of the email.
Improvements left and right.
Oh, it's amazing. This question is from Amy. I've read some scientific papers on how emotions such as anger and anxiety increase inflammatory cytokine release and the risk of chronic disease. While I've seen the research on how negative emotions increase disease risk and progression, I'm wondering what is out there demonstrating the opposite, that gratitude, happiness, and joy decrease disease risk and progression. Even better, is there anything demonstrating a shift in attitude from negative to positive reduces inflammation or disease progression? Thanks. I think Amy reads some like really dorky things. I think she's a super nerd. Do you think she's a super nerd? She used the word inflammatory cytokine. I'm in love with Amy. That's all I'm saying.
We can be in love with Amy and not say that she does dorky things. I feel like nerd is a much more like respectful term.
We
love you, Amy. Yes.
I identify myself as a dorky nerd.
I self-identify as a dorky nerd.
As a dorky nerd. So I was just more making the statement that Amy and I both like the words inflammatory cytokine release. That's all I was just identifying with Amy. But yes, I guess some people have negative connotations around dork or geek, but not nerd doesn't have as much negative connotation. So we'll go with nerd.
Verbal hug all around.
So, as I mentioned, the research into the health impact of positive affect and optimism is really phenomenal. And actually, basically any sort of there are basically positive psychological aspects of well-being. So it's not just things like optimism, but it includes being somebody who regularly experiences positive emotions, who has high life satisfaction. What's really fascinating is there's this growing body of very like rigorously well-controlled scientific studies showing that this can reduce risk of chronic disease and even increase lifespan. And it's getting to be such a huge body of scientific literature that there's actually some great meta-analyses now. There's prospective cohort studies. There's actually quite a lot of data. And I'm going to highlight a few of the studies that, as I was doing my reading, I felt made the strongest case for prioritizing optimism or trying to adopt a more optimistic mindset in the pursuit of whatever our life goals are. So there was a really fascinating 2017 study called Optimism and Cause-Specific Mortality. It was a prospective cohort study. It was data from the Nurses' Health Study. And what they did, I thought, was really clever, because what they did was they measured something called dispositional optimism. And this is done with a series of questionnaires. But it's basically a way of quantifying how optimistic you are by default. So are you somebody who, your natural state is to think the best, to think things will work out, to think, it's okay if it's raining today because the weather will get better by the end of the week, right? If you're just a type of person who by default tends to be more optimistic versus somebody who's, it's the opposite of that. And they actually divided people up into quartiles. So it was bottom 25%, the most pessimistic people, then sort of moderately pessimistic, moderately optimistic, and then very optimistic. And what they did was this was done in 2004. They measured with these psychological surveys how optimistic these people were. And then they tracked mortality rates, both all-cause mortality, which is an overall measure of health and longevity, versus cause-specific mortality, which gives you more detailed data about things like cardiovascular disease and cancer and autoimmune disease, from 2006 to 2012. So there was this period of time in between that's basically considered like a washout period, which means that if you happened to catch a pessimistic person on a really good day and they tested more optimistic, this period of time kind of corrects for that. So it kind of allows you to be able to more accurately track data to dispositional optimism. So it kind of takes away a little bit of the effect of either catching an optimistic person on a really bad day or a pessimistic person on a really good day and sort of quantifying them, putting them in their quartiles incorrectly. And so what they found was that there was a pretty remarkable improvement in health and longevity in the most optimistic people compared to the least optimistic people. And so what they found was generally it was about a 30% reduction in all-cause mortality, which was huge. And this was once they had adjusted for sociodemographic factors. When they started adjusting for health behaviors, so they started like separating out diet, smoking, how active they are, whether or not they have any health conditions, whether or not they have depression. So they started getting really granular in terms of what they were correcting for. And this is really important when you have this type of study that's looking for associations, is to see this extensive list of other behaviors that they're correcting for. So they corrected for absolutely everything that science can tell us has an impact on all-cause mortality, and they still had about a 10% difference. So somebody who is eating a healthy diet, who's very, very active, who doesn't smoke, who has low stress, who doesn't have a family history of disease, still had about a 10% improvement in their health outcomes if they were optimistic compared to somebody who was not optimistic. And as they started to look through different causes of death, they found that there was an improvement from optimism, not just in this general measurement of health and longevity, but also in cancer, in cardiovascular disease, in respiratory disease, and infection. And depending on exactly what they were looking at, sometimes the effect was even stronger. So they were finding, for example, probably some of the best effects are cardiovascular disease. This actually makes some sense. You know, in cardiovascular disease, you're talking more like a 20 to 25% effect. And given how you could draw a fairly direct link between optimism and perceived stress, and given how sensitive the cardiovascular system is to stress, it sort of makes some sense. Probably the weakest association was with cancer, but there were certain cancers that had stronger associations. So, for example, colorectal cancer had a bigger, you know, a lower risk from being optimistic. So it was a really, really fascinating study, and I thought it was very, very well done. There was also another study. Now, this was done back in 2009, but what was really cool about this was it was a meta-analysis that looked at pretty much all of the papers that measured optimism and health outcomes leading up to that point. And what I really liked about this paper was they actually did analyses on and meta-analyses on papers that actually looked at things like immune function. And that always is really fascinating to me because I think the immune system is super interesting, but also because it's very, very relevant to all of our listeners with autoimmune disease and chronic illness in general. But I really think of anything that helps to regulate the immune system as being like a worthwhile thing to incorporate into the autoimmune protocol. So overall, they corrected for all different kinds of other behaviors. They grouped in terms of different types of outcomes. So it wasn't just all-cause mortality, but it was also cardiovascular and immune function, cancer, outcomes related to pregnancy, things like they actually looked at some pain research, which was really cool. And overall, that they found the effect was about a 17% improvement in outcomes. So about, you know, 17% risk reduction across the board. Again, it was a little, you know, it's different for different outcomes. So it's different diseases. So again, like cardiovascular disease is sort of like a 25% effect, which is really, really cool. What was interesting was this study showed a slightly bigger effect for cancer. So across the board, they found a 27% improvement in cancer. They found improvements in pain, pregnancy. What was fascinating to me was about a 12 to 20%. It depended on exactly how they separated out the studies. 12 to 20% improvement in immune function measurements. And this was looking at things like C-reactive protein, inflammatory cytokines. So these were actually the studies that they were incorporating into this analysis were looking at quantitative measurements of how the immune system is functioning. There was a couple of studies that looked at T-cell subsets, which is fascinating to me because they were actually showing that just being optimistic helps your immune system be more regulated. And again, this sort of large analyses of all of the data up until this point confirmed what this, you know, really well-designed prospective study that's more recent also showed, which is that dispositional optimism, so, you know, just generally expecting that good things will happen, is very strongly linked to reduced risk of chronic health conditions, reduced risk of mortality, and that translates to improved health and improved longevity, which is fascinating to me because it really demonstrates something beyond placebo and beyond the belief that good things will happen, that simply approaching life with that positive affect and that optimistic attitude, there's something about the hormonal environment, the neurotransmitter environment, that goes along with that, that is then feeding into different biological systems and overall benefiting our health. So the question I felt from there is, okay, great. So it's great if you're optimistic. What if you're not? What if you're that's not your default? How can you become more optimistic? Can you do something other than, be like determined to be optimistic? Are there scientifically proven methods to actually increase optimism? And the answer is yes. There actually are a number of different methods that have been designed to address optimism and sort of related, general just sort of approach to life. What's interesting is there have been some twin studies done that have shown that about 25% of a person's dispositional optimism is heritable, which means it's inherited, it's linked to genetics, which is great news because it means that 75% is environment, it's learned. And so that means that pretty much anybody, no matter how sort of default negative you may be as a starting point, it reinforces that with at least some effort that anybody can become more optimistic and enjoy the health benefits from optimism.
Can we just pause to talk about how cool twin studies are? I mean, I wanted twins when I was trying to get pregnant with Finn and eat so many sweet potatoes and it didn't happen for me, but...
Hang on. Pause. Was this the pause within the pause? Sweet potatoes, what?
Whether it's an old wives tale or there's actual science, I don't know. But I read online that that was one of the ways to increase likelihood of twins. And coincidence or not, I actually knew someone who had twins and it wasn't, she had identical twins. It wasn't in their family at all. And she was only eating like sweet potatoes beforehand because her 18-month-old son only ate sweet potatoes. Like that was the only food that he liked. And so she was eating a ton of sweet potatoes. And she and I had like this big long conversation about how she felt like that was the reason that she had twins. So anyway, it's a complete aside.
I think that's awesome. And I wish I'd known about the sweet potato thing because I would have done it. Because I super wanted twins. And twins do actually run in my family, but there aren't any for three generations. Mm. But I felt like, oh, you know, like it skipped a generation, but then it skipped another generation. So it's going to land on me. And I was really like super into it, but I'd never heard the sweet potato thing. So there's probably no science to support that, but you never know. Maybe it's there. I'll look. But okay.
Yeah. I recognize that there's probably not any science. Anyway, the point being, twins are so cool. Like, yes. They're just so cool. And the idea that you can do these kinds of studies is so fascinating to me. So that's all. You just like mentioned it like it was no big deal. And I was like, but wait.
Well, okay. Here's the thing that's just fascinating to me, though, is because you know this is like the evil twin, good twin study, right? Because it's measuring optimism in twins. So you know that's what it is. It's like the good twin, evil twin trying to identify which one's which. I love twin studies as well. And I find this type of data that you really can't get any other way to be fascinating. But it does mean that somebody has like a grumpy twin out there.
I would be the grumpy twin. It's cool. I don't mind acknowledging that. And I'm sure that grumpy twin is like, yeah, I'm not optimistic. But I strive to be because it helps my health.
Right? It's like a 10 to 30% effect. It's totally worthwhile pursuing.
Like when we found out that the podcast hadn't recorded and I was like, oh, great. Another opportunity to improve it.
That was exactly your initial reaction, Stacey. Wow.
Nailed it.
I want to actually talk about a few different science-backed strategies for improving optimism. And the first one that has been is sort of like the newest but pretty exciting strategy is called cognitive bias modification. And there have been a few randomized trials now. Now they've been short term, so there hasn't been good studies looking at how long the effect lasts, so how long you need to necessarily do these treatments in order to have sort of a lasting impact on dispositional optimism. But they're really cool, and there's been a variety of studies done over the last decade or so using sort of variations of this methodology. And so it sort of boils down to giving people either a story, so it's either a purely auditory stimulus, or they get shown pictures, and it's some kind of situation, and the person is told to very actively imagine themselves in that scenario, or to you know, describe what's going on in these pictures, right, to generate a mental image, so that the participants are, or if you're using this as a treatment with a therapist, you would be instructed to basically engage with the scenario so that you are actively working through your expectations. So you're imagining yourself in that situation in, say, the story that you've heard or in the pictures. And then what happens is, so you're an active participant basically in your mind. And then the story will resolve. So if it's an auditory story, the story will end. Or if it's pictures, you'll be shown a few more pictures and it resolves. And what happens is, when you're told to participate, it is ambiguous whether or not this is going to go sideways. But as you mentally engage with the scenario, it then always resolves positively. And so people are typically given a dozen or two dozen of these in any particular session, several sessions a week. The sessions typically last 20 minutes or so, 15 to 20 minutes. And what's cool is in the controls in these studies, what they take away is the prompt to imagine yourself as an engaged participant. And the other thing they take away is the always positive endings to the scenarios. So if you're a control in these studies, half of the scenarios would end positively and the other half would end negatively. So it's those are the things that they put the controls through, which I found cool. I was like, how do you control for this kind of study? That's how. And what they're actually showing is that over, you know, 4 weeks of sessions, three times a week, that they can have measurable improvements in mood. They can show decreases in trait anxiety, in depression, in neuroticism, and they show an increase in optimism and positive affect with this cognitive bias modification. And this is a type of therapy that you can actually get with a therapist. And so it really does seem to, in a very quantifiable way, improve all of the psychological traits that studies show improve health outcomes. So this is one really cool thing that you could find a therapist to do. I also want to talk about the second strategy from improving optimism is definitely something that you can do at home for very inexpensive. And it is mindfulness meditation. And Stacey, I know you love meditating.
Just as much as instinctually for me to say, well, what a great opportunity to make a podcast better the second time. That's exactly how I feel about meditation. Though I will say, since our last recording of this podcast, which you listeners were not able to enjoy, one of the things that I talked about was how using the Juve light in the morning for me, ever since our podcast on that, by the way, I've been pretty good about doing that every morning because the health benefits were crazy. And so one of the things that we talked about is that I really enjoy that and it sets me up for success for the day. Like, oh, I'm doing this thing for me first thing in the morning. It helps me kind of set my intention for the day and think about all the things that I need to do and how I'm going to accomplish them, and really is a focus time and also helps me remember that it's okay to spend time on me and my health and that kind of stuff. But I had said that I do usually use my phone during that period because I don't like to meditate. And, you know, that idea of like turning off your brain is very hard for me. And so it's been a week since last we spoke about this topic. And I have each morning since then, you're going to talk about the science of meditation and stuff, intentionally put my phone down. Now I have like listened to a podcast or some things like that, sometimes, but I'm embracing the idea that this could be my meditation period and trying to allow myself to like truly zone out and shut off as much as I can. And I might still be thinking the whole time and I'm okay with that. Like this is my version of mindfulness. And so as listeners, you're listening to Sarah talk about the concept of meditation and the science behind it. Just think to yourself, what are the things that I could do in my life to give myself this 10 to 20 minute window each day? Because it does have such a significant impact on both your health as well as your ability to think optimistic and have this abundance mindset that we're talking about. Because you can set your intention for that day during that mindful period.
What I think is really interesting about meditation is that we have so many stereotypes around meditation, and mindfulness meditation has actually been very, very well studied. It comes from neuropsychology. Like, it's a very sort of different beast than that, you know, Buddhist monk, you know, in a cave for 3 months. Granted, it definitely helped that those boys from Thailand who were trapped in the cave for, what was it, 9 days or 11 days over the summer, their coach had like trained in meditation as a Buddhist monk in caves, and he actually like taught the boys how to meditate, and that's one of the reasons why apparently they all survived this amazing like thing over the summer. I was riveted. I was like totally attached to my newsfeed when that was happening. But we have these views of like, you know, somebody sitting in the, you know, full lotus position with their, you know, singing om and just kind of, it just seems goofy. But what mindfulness practice really is it is a typically a practice that involves sitting quietly, typically closing your eyes, often focusing on breathing, and really turning your awareness inward. So it really is about being attentive and aware of your current experiences and being able to be receptive to them and non-judgmental. And there's a variety of ways that you can learn to do mindfulness. I think typically the most accessible is to do a guided meditation. And there's a bunch of apps that you can get on your phone for free. There's the ones that everyone's heard of, like Calm and Headspace. My new favorite is called Insight Timer, which is also a free app. And there's a lot of mindfulness leaders who will put their meditations into Insight Timer for free with the idea that you might then go do a retreat, a 7-day mindfulness retreat with them somewhere, or you might go to their classes or, you know, something. But it's a way of for them to increase their exposure to mindfulness students. But there's a really amazing collection of high quality mindfulness meditations within that app. And there's different styles. So there's typical guided meditation body scans, which I think is probably like that's the type of mindfulness meditation that you might do at the end of a yoga class. But then there's meditations that are really focused on emotional release or gratitude or dealing with prejudice, right? There's all different kinds of very, very specific meditations. There's also meditations that are entirely sound based. So it might be nature sounds or gongs or basically a lot of stuff that comes from the new age sort of theta wave music that are designed to, through various sounds, put your brain into a meditative state by altering the brainwave patterns. And so that actually also has some science behind it, which is pretty cool. So there's a variety of different things. You don't just have to listen to somebody telling you to relax your toes and then relax your ankles. And if that's not your thing,
that's not my thing.
That's fine. I think what is cool about that app is it gives you for free, it gives you an entrance into all a variety of different types of mindfulness meditation. And then even from there, I think it's important to sort of emphasize that you know, going for a walk without your phone can be a mindfulness practice. A huge part of mindfulness is really about having some time to just be in your own head. A lot of mindfulness practice is about not necessarily emptying your brain, but about acknowledging, right? It's acknowledging what's going on in there and kind of like letting it go. There's this amazing, and we'll have to put the link to this video in the show notes. Cause there's this amazing YouTube video of this like Buddhist monk. He's like a huge mindfulness leader. And he talks about like the chattering monkey in the back of the brain. And I always think about that because A, he's hysterically funny and this is just an amazing video. But B, like that really, to me, it resonates, right? It sounds very much like what I'm trying to achieve when I'm practicing mindfulness. It's like, yeah, that monkey will not shut up. And mindfulness is about giving him a banana and just having 2 minutes of peace. And one of the things that he emphasizes in the video is that it doesn't need to be an hour meditation practice or 15 minutes, that mindfulness is about finding those moments throughout the day of peace. And it's about, you know, that closing your eyes and taking 3 deep breaths. Those small moments are additive and they have tremendous benefit. Now, all that being said, most of the studies that look at mindfulness practice will look at least 10-minute practices. But what's really cool is they're starting to introduce mindfulness practices in schools. My kids have been introduced to mindfulness in their school. And that is actually leading to some really interesting studies that have been done in schools showing that it improves metacognition, which is basically emotional regulation and behavioral regulation, which is really fascinating. But that's adding to this really impressive body of scientific literature showing that mindfulness practice increases basically these psychological traits that are linked to positive affect and optimism. And it has been shown it increases positive emotions, it reduces stress, it makes people feel more energetic, more at peace, optimistic, happy, feeling more accepted. The effects are pretty amazing. And so I wanted to kind of emphasize, you know, these are the sort of the two for the average person who's just looking to be more optimistic. These are the two different strategies, cognitive bias modification and mindfulness practice. And I feel like while you can do mindfulness courses, my mom actually did the mindfulness accreditation from UCLA, which is a phenomenal program. And I'm so impressed. And I've actually started reading the books, you know, written by a lot of those professors. It's like a really cool program. So there are definitely places where you can do advanced training in mindfulness. But mindfulness is very it's very accessible for people thanks to apps, thanks to things like guided meditations, whereas cognitive bias modification would be more in the realm of wanting to work with a therapist to help, switch from a more sort of negative, pessimistic attitude towards a more positive and optimistic attitude as a default. That doesn't mean you're never going to get angry or you're never going to get, that you're never going to have a negative emotion. What it basically means is what your default is and how quickly you rebound to your default. So those are, I think, the two strategies for the sort of, I want to say normal person, but like person who's not dealing with an additional challenge to optimism. The other two techniques for increasing optimism come out of research in depression and PTSD. And so these are, I wanted to bring these into the podcast because these more specifically would be appropriate for somebody who has something like PTSD or depression, anxiety disorder, bipolar disease, obsessive compulsive disorder. So for somebody who has these additional barriers towards improving optimism, there's also some really cool other therapies that have been very, very well studied. And so I thought that it was worthwhile mentioning these in this entire conversation because this is the next level stuff. So one is called emotional freedom technique. It's also called tapping. It actually is very interestingly derived from sort of Eastern medicine, but it actually has been very well studied in scientific studies now, showing that it can improve a lot of these sort of psychological symptoms, things like distress, pain, cravings, depression, anxiety. It can actually improve your cortisol regulation. It can improve coping. It can improve quality of life. It can reduce distress and depression, anxiety, and even pain perception in people with PTSD. So it really does have some really good studies that have been well controlled to help improve sort of the psychological aspects of well-being that are linked with health in people with these additional challenges towards achieving that sort of level of optimism and positive affect. So emotional freedom techniques have been well studied. So again, this is something that you would do with a certified therapist, but it is a pretty cool therapy. The other one that has also been really developed for PTSD is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EMDR therapy. And EMDR therapy, again, it was sort of designed for veterans returning from violent battle zones and violence and being able to process what they were going through. And EMDR, it's a multi-phase. My understanding of it is that it is designed to separate out an emotion from a memory so that the memory is not traumatizing. So this has very specifically been designed for PTSD, although I do believe there are therapists who are using it for other sort of related types of challenges. But it is, again, sort of a multi-step and very rigorous, right? So there's a very standard protocol that a therapist would go through. And there have been a number of studies showing that it can dramatically benefit people with PTSD and just overall increase coping, increase things like anxiety, depression. It can improve relaxation, reduce stress. So all of the things that would sort of be a first step for somebody who is dealing with those types of challenges towards getting to a place of, optimism and positivity and enjoying those types of health benefits that come with it. So I just kind of wanted to mention these two sort of next level therapies for any of our listeners or, your friends, loved ones who could potentially benefit from these types of therapies on their road towards something like mindfulness or cognitive bias modification for anybody who's dealing with those additional challenges.
I have previously heard of tapping before, so that's interesting to me, and I love the idea of the science for more in-depth support, but I think also I've heard of a lot of people being able to use it still in daily life and practice for, like you said, anxiety and that kind of stuff. So,
Tapping especially has been used in a more variety of different things, like addiction, I don't think I mentioned. So I think, and tapping to me, I have to honestly say, I'm a generally fairly skeptical person when it comes to alternative therapies. So it's one of the questions I get asked most often is, have you heard of blank and is it, you know, is it good? And there's so many things out there that are not based in science. There's no scientific evidence support. And like people are being sold, machines to use at home that are thousands of dollars. Like it's a whole industry of interventions that are for whatever, right? Pain or inflammation, or it'll make you smarter, whatever it is, that's really sort of preying on people's inability to differentiate that sort of pseudoscience sales pitch from something that's truly science backed. And I have to say, you know, when I first heard about tapping, I mean, the way it was described to me, I was like, what? Is that a thing? But the reasons why I thought it was really important to include in this podcast is it is a thing. And even though it involves acupuncture points, it really does have some very compelling science behind its effects. So, and very large effects, like far beyond placebo. So I did want to sort of mention that as a cool thing with science behind it. I like those.
We always like things with science behind them, which is why I appreciate your willingness to tackle this topic with me twice.
I know, twice. I must be a really positive person to talk about positivity twice, right?
You must be. and you know, doing this kind of show has helped my little black heart, you know, swell just a little bit, a la the Grinch.
I so wish I could quote the Grinch right now, because his heart grew 3 sizes that day. See, I wish I knew the whole poem, because that'd be an amazing little party trick to pull out right now.
Matt's probably going to drop in some sort of sound bite, but
wait.
I just want to first, obviously, thank you for the science, but also just bring it back down to a realistic everyday kind of example. I know I talked about the change that I made even just this week from, you know, since we recorded the podcast and looking at, okay, what's the next thing I can do? I mean, you and I often talk on the podcast about how, you know, we've been doing this for 8 years now. You had your 8-year anniversary, right?
Seven.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, we've been doing this a really long time, and therefore, you know, we are more able to go beyond the basics of, you know, the simple, well, not the simple, but the bigger things that are overwhelming in your life when you first do them and then become habit later on. It's easier to move on to the next thing that you can potentially look at or improve in your life. And I know for me, stress is one of those things that, you know, severely affects my digestion and my overall health and well-being. And what are the things that I can do to reduce the stress in my life? Because it will, especially long-term, affect my health. Stress is the number one killer in America. Because I think that's the statistic. Last I read it, when you look at all the different things that are caused by stress, heart attack, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we didn't super go into it today, but you did talk about, you know, mortality rates and all that kind of stuff. We have even, like, there's a chart in our show notes. We can put it in, we can put it in the show notes that, you know, talks about things like cancer and stroke and different things that are affected by this idea of optimism. And when there's something that affects health and your ability to be alive longer that severely, I think it warrants this idea of, well, what can I do today? What's the little step that I can take towards this? But not to overwhelm yourself with, okay, I got to download this app and I got to do the tapping and then I got to get the Juve light and then I got to do this. And, oh, when am I going to meal prep? And then you're only adding stress to your life, right? So, you know, what I suggest is do the thing that we implemented and think positively. Think about the one thing that you can achieve. What can you be successful at doing? And then set about doing it. And if you don't, and if you have a day where you miss it and you don't do it, that's okay. You know, like you've made progress the other days and you'll do it tomorrow, and don't stress yourself out about it. And I say that mostly for my own benefit, because I need to remember that for myself as well. But I just, you know, this idea that, you know, we're all going to hug each other and sing Kumbaya and everything's great. Like, I get that's not the reality, but we can all make steps towards being kinder to each other, being kinder to ourselves, being forward thinking when it comes to what can I positively impact in the future or in, you know, the people around me. And that sort of thing really will help you achieve improved health. So I thank you, Sarah, for covering this topic, and I hope that it's helpful for people, but not overwhelming. We need to do the opposite of being overwhelmed.
It's true. And I, again, I think one of the reasons I want to echo your point, one of the reasons why this is so fascinating for us to get into is that we have figured out the diet piece. This, I think, falls under the lifestyle piece, but it's also sort of like it's not the obvious, right? Eat well, exercise, get enough sleep, manage your stress, right? This is kind of next level. But I also think that given the links between things like optimism and positive affect and other or reduced risk of other sort of behaviors, right? Like, there's some interesting research in here that we mentioned about addiction and cravings and sort of destructive behaviors. This can be something that you work on implementing earlier on to help succeed in all of the habit formation that goes along with changing diet and lifestyle. So it's sort of individual, I think, where this is on the priority list in terms of, you know, working on it to, you know, working on optimism and positivity. But I think that it's very compelling science that it needs to be at least somewhere on the to-do list. Like it's certainly not going to be high up on the list for a lot of people, but it is, there is a point of the health journey where this needs to be the focus. I think the science really is really compelling in terms of the benefits that we can experience from figuring out this aspect of mindset.
Awesome. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to episode 318 of the Paleo View, because Sarah loves looking at those numbers every week and making sure that we know how to do simple math.
Dude, I might not have, this might be 319. I might not have updated this.
Oh, that's right, because the outlines are upside down.
Huh? Yeah.
Yep, totally. Well, listeners, who knows?
Thanks for listening to 319.
Who knows what number this is, but we appreciate you being here. It's gotten too high to count. I mean, let's be real. So the fact that you're still here is wonderful, and we appreciate you. If you feel the same way, if we could ask you to leave a review, share this podcast with loved ones, share the link in your social media, whatever it is, maybe that grumpy neighbor, you know, you just send him a link on Facebook. It helps us reach a greater audience, and we appreciate it so much. So thank you again for being here, and we'll be back again next week.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
All right, I'm going to post like 30 pictures to my Instagram stories from our camping trip right now, and then I'm going to go to bed.
I can't wait to check it out.
Such a good – so A, no bears. B, no venomous snakes. C,
double bonus.
Stove.
Like you could have just stopped right there.
It was so great. Working camp stove. So I would literally be like, I feel like a cup of tea. I can just boil water in 20 seconds. Like it was so great. And then because
I feel
all
like
of
the
that
next
stuff,
camping trip is just going to be a letdown because you can't achieve this level of greatness again.
Well, so David's still not sleeping super well in a tent. So I still have debugging to do. I still have to figure out – like, and I've bought him the like super cozy queen-sized air mattress cot thing. He thinks he might need a better pillow. I'm like, okay. I think he mostly just needs
to relax,
to get used to it. Like
maybe he
you
needs
know,
some melatonin.
I think he took melatonin. Oh. I don't know. Maybe he didn't. But yeah, I think it's just right. Especially in Georgia, the tree frogs are so loud here. They're like, they're crazy. So I think it was just like strange sounds, strange place. But even like the second night, it got quite cold. It dropped down about 60 at night. And that was just so lovely for me. I slept so well when it was cold outside, but I was all like bundled up in the sleeping bag. And he did not sleep super well. So there's still debugging to do. But what was lovely about it was we actually had time to go on some really cool hikes. We hiked up Black Rock Mountain, and we didn't realize it until we were halfway down and we finally hit the sign. If we'd gone the other way, we would have hit the sign on our way up. But you hike up to the mountain and then you walk along this ridge, the whole like up to the mountain, up to the summit. And the ridge that we walked along was the Continental Divide.
What?
Yes.
That's in this area? I don't even understand.
So, I mean, I would literally, there was a sign that was like Continental Divide is like right here. And we're like,
you know, my understanding of geography is such that if you were telling me that and the thing is in Siberia, like I would have literally no idea the difference between Georgia and Siberia's Continental Divide.
So it runs north south, and on the east side of it, rainfall drains towards the Atlantic Ocean, and on the left side of it, rainfall drains towards the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico.
So there's more than one? Because you said the east side of it.
Yeah, so the Continental Divide is basically, it's like a ridge that goes straight, you know, from south to north, and it divides where rainfall drains to. So rainfall drains to the Atlantic Ocean on the east side of it, and it drains to the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico on the left side of it. And then there's like another one in the Pacific where it like drains to the Pacific Ocean. And I don't know where there's other big rivers, I assume. So I was like, this is cool. I had no idea this was going to be part of our trip. So we hiked up a mountain. It was a legit hard hike. The kids made it. It was funny though, because the last little bit, like, I was watching my whole family and they're all like, their legs are like wobbly, and I'm like, okay, you can slow down, you don't want to fall. And I'm like, these guys. And then we like went back to our campsite and had lunch and like hung out for a bit, and then we did a hike down into a gorge to see a waterfall, which was definitely the hike that we should have done in the morning and done them in the opposite order. Because when you hike down to see something pretty, it's very deceiving. And then you have to hike back out. And it was steep enough that there were areas where it was just stairs. So it was, you know, you'd go up like six flights of stairs because this part of the hill is so steep. And it was quite a hike out of that gorge. But it was a lovely waterfall, so it was super worth it.
I love waterfalls. Have you ever been to Niagara?
Yeah.
I have not. It's on my bucket list.
I want to bring my kids. So my kids haven't seen it.
I want to see it both warm and cold. Like the idea of a frozen waterfall.
I have not ever seen it in the winter. But I also, when you go to the Canadian side, because now I've applied for American citizenship. So I totally think America's better.
If this is going in the bloopers, you better talk positively about America.
Except for Niagara Falls. So the Canadian side of Niagara Falls is objectively superior to the American side. So cross the border and go to the Canadian side. Because it's just that the horseshoe's on the Canadian side and then the flat part's on the American side. And you can't really get a good view of the horseshoe from the American side. You have to come over to the Canadian side for it. And you can actually go into these tunnels under Niagara Falls and like see the falls from underneath in the horseshoe from the Canadian side, which is super, super cool. So it's just, you got that
passport. I think if we're going to go that north, like why not go to Canada? Yeah. The kids have never been.